This is ensemble member John Michael Hill, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theater Company podcast.
Hello, this is literary manager Joy Meads, and I'm here talking to Frances Guinan, who is playing Nag in our current production of Endgame. Hi, Fran.
Hi, Joy. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Grand.
Well, why don't we just start out? Would you tell us about your character in Endgame?
Nag is the father of Ham, played by Billy Peterson, and the husband of Nell, who's played by Martha. Martha and I are deposited in garbage cans for metaphorical reasons. We apparently lost our legs in a tandem bicycle accident, and have been relegated to garbage cans in our son's house, which has simplified life a great deal. One of the big subjects of conversation is the difference between sand and sawdust in the bottom of our garbage cans, and which is better. Yeah. So yes, I play. It's a dad role.
And so you're essentially doing all your acting from the shoulders up.
Yes.
And what's that like?
It's kind of interesting. It actually reminded me once or twice of this silly week or two I had in college with doing mask work. And I don't know, for some reason it just made me make bigger faces, even with the mask on. But this is, it's very odd. I haven't worked with Martha Lavey in, since Savages, which is, I think, back during the Truman administration. And now that I finally have the opportunity to do so, one of the stage directions is that we don't actually look at one another. It's we're so stiff from lying in our garbage cans that we can't quite turn all the way towards one another. So that was a bit disappointing, but it was what Mr. Beckett insisted upon. So most of it's vocal work, which is a good discipline for me, because I have a tendency to. I'm one of those actors that Hamlet warned against, you know, don't slash the air with your hands and that sort of thing. So anyway, it's a good discipline, and it's been an interesting several weeks working on it.
Well, it's been quite a season for you. So far in the season, you've played, I'm going to number them off.
Sure.
The flamboyant Scotsman, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, yeah, that was fun.
Yes. Jonathan Cole, a somewhat repressed English mid-century paleontologist.
Yeah.
Donnie, Chicago, small-time crook from the 70s. And now Nag, an elderly man confined to a garbage can. And one of the things that's been so fun for me from the perspective of, you know, an audience member watching the season is seeing, like, the protean quality that you have in all of these roles. And can you talk to me a little bit about the journey of the season for you and how you approach all of these extraordinarily varied characters?
Well, let me see. A lot of it has to do. A lot of it has to do with like exterior appearances. For instance, playing Conan Doyle. It was such fun. The Scots accent helped quite a bit. Now on this one, it's a bit more mid-Atlantic. It's actually a play that was written in French, translated into English, had its first production in London. And Beckett actually reworked the script for an American production, I believe in New York. So it's a little difficult to know quite what dialect to use. The writing seems to slide between Cockney and upper middle class British. To Irish luckily I have a very silly, probably the silliest thing I've ever read in Beckett, a very silly story and a terrible joke to tell very early in the play. So that's that has its own propulsion. It's great fun to do. So
it's great fun to hear as well. It's quite funny in performance. I was really struck by that in our all-staff reading that we did a few weeks ago. And I'm wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about the humor in the play, which I think doesn't always strike one in the page, at least the way on the page, at least the way that many of us first became acquainted with Beckett in, you know, college literature classes, yeah, where the conversations are all very heavy. You know, can you talk about the humor in the play?
Well, a lot of it is a lot of it is language based, juxtapositions back and forth. For instance, one of my favorite lines in, or exchanges in the play is between. Between Ham and Clove, in which Ham says, "We do what we can," to which Clove responds, "We shouldn't," which I think is very funny. Plus the joke that I tell in this raconteur sort of joke is a terribly old joke and sounds very strange coming out of Beckett's pen, except that it becomes very revelatory in terms of the character. A lot of the humor is very slapstick. There's a scene where Clove gets Jan Barford gets so angry at Ham that he practically falls off a stepladder, which he somehow managed to like balance on two legs for this seemingly weird amount of time before he comes back down. It can be a very funny play. It's a very darkly funny play.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that the parents are in garbage cans with the legs missing, it's a very grim joke.
Mm-hmm.
A very grim comic situation. So I would say the humor is very dark and very language based.
Both this play in Beckett and in the last play in American Buffalo by David Mamet, you have two playwrights who are very precise in their vision, almost to the point of being arguably prescriptive, you know?
Oh, I would say they're very prescriptive. I know, especially when Mamet directs his own material, one has to be, well, one always has to be, but especially with Mamet, one has to be very precise in terms of getting the language correct, getting the lines down and cold, because so much of the meaning and the thrust of the play depends simply on the music that the audience hears. I would say in Beckett, the music is probably less important than creating a very compelling situation on stage. It's not absolutely clear what's going on from moment to moment in terms of plot, simply because it's, in a lot of ways, it's a very metaphorical situation. I mean, we seem to be in a situation where we're at the end of the world or at the end of civilization. It's not necessarily after a plague or a war or anything like that. It seems to be driven more by entropy than it does anything else, which I think is a wonderful metaphor for, the world in the 50s after World War II, after the debacle in Europe. So what happens is that one has to be very precise in terms of the emotional life of the characters. And, of course, you have to have very specific things to play, but that isn't always immediately apparent to the audience what might specifically be driving the emotional content for the characters, but in terms of plot. But it is very compelling emotionally, and it's very specific, despite the fact that it's in kind of what one might think of as an absurdist situation. So the last week or so, we've had, Bill and Jan and Frank have had wonderful success in terms of creating this very strong and sometimes poisonous emotional bond between Nag and Clove, around which the entire play revolves. And whatever sort of slim plot actually unfolds over the course of the evening. And it's now quite compelling and great fun to watch. So
excited to
see
that.
Yeah, I am too. I am too.
You know, one final question. Your relationship with your son, Ham, there's a reversal of sorts in which the son has such control over the father. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's tired of you, he can order you to be bottled up, the lid put back on the garbage can. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, the dynamic between you, what you and Billy have discovered about your relationship at this point in rehearsal.
Oh, one of the interesting things that we talked about in terms of my, at least my experience in the play, is that you learn that in dealing with your children, that, oh, you swear you're not going to make the same mistakes that your parents did. And yet, so much of what you exchange with your children is verbal. And a lot of those verbal cues are created in childhood, listening to your parents as well. I mean, all those sort of catchphrases, the comedic catchphrases, don't make me stop this car, or I'll give you something to cry about, or that sort of thing. I think those phrases actually get passed down from generation to generation to generation. And while I think we may make our best efforts to be better parents than the ones we had, I mean, good as they may have been, I think so much of what we get from our parents is actually verbal. And there's such a strong emotional content that exists in tandem with that we actually end up, unless we make great efforts to break it, we actually end up in the same habits as our parents had. I mean, I have things that I have said to my son that I know. I would bet my life that my great-grandfather said to my grandfather, simply because, as a child, I mean, that stuff doesn't get filtered. That's just imprinted immediately upon that, well, I guess what I like to call that lizard part of your brain that jumps out whether you will or not, you know, when you get into an emotional situation. And we find that Beckett has their catchphrases that both the father and the son use. Well, to make it short, while they're telling a story, they both use that phrase. There are several phrases that run through the play that are identical for both father and son. It's interesting. It's an absurd situation, and yet Beckett, in his wisdom, has written something that's quite realistic in terms of the emotional relationships. Interesting.
Friend, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. For more information about Endgame or to learn more about Steppenwolf, please visit us at www.steppenwolf.org.